And good morning. It's 8:19. You're listening to Morning Edition on KASU. I'm Jonathan Reeves, News Director here at KASU. And joining me on the phone lines right now, we're talking to U.S. Representative Rick Crawford. You're in this, and thank you so much. We appreciate you, Mr. Crawford. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, I had several questions for you about the farm bill. Let's talk about that this morning. When is the House expected to vote on the farm bill, and how is it looking to get it passed and signed into law by this summer?
Well, we'll probably take it up this week. I'm going to say probably Wednesday, Thursday. We'll have, and probably, hopefully, final passage Thursday, maybe Friday. But I suspect we've already seen the rule debate has already been scheduled. We know we're going to start that probably as early as tomorrow. But typically what you'll see is tomorrow's first day in session, so there'll be a late vote series. Tomorrow evening, the rule debate should start on Wednesday morning. Then we should debate the bill on Thursday, entertain whatever amendments are offered. It's going to be a structured rule, which means it's not going to be carte blanche on there. It's going to have to be your amendments will have to be narrowly focused on the farm bill to be allowed. And I suspect either late Thursday or Friday, We'll vote on the passage of the final bill.
What were the most difficult parts of getting it through the Ag Committee?
Well, it really comes down to nutrition. That was the most contentious part. And quite frankly, the commodity title and most of the farm bill that affects the agricultural production across the country, is very little change to that. On conservation, there was some consolidation of programs. Doesn't mean elimination of programs, but consolidation in order to save some money and more effectively administer those programs more cost effectively. And so, there's some slight changes there, but it's not going to be disruptive by any means. In fact, it will actually improve the level of service that producers get because there were some communications gaps between sub-agencies of USDA and administering those programs. And so that's the whole point of trying to streamline these and make them better and more efficient. Of course, there's some cost savings associated with that as well. But the real contention came from the nutrition bill, or a nutrition title. So what happened is we had been working with our friends across the aisle really, pretty effectively up to the point that we started to move on the nutrition title. And at that point, they pretty much abruptly pulled up and left and said, "We're done. We're not going to talk to you any further about the farm bill." They didn't like the approach that we took in, the nutrition title, essentially sort of reworking, reprogramming, not cutting the nutrition title baseline, but actually reprogramming some of those dollars to allow for these nutrition programs at the state level and at their discretion to implement work requirements based on a 20-hour work requirement or educational programs that the nutrition dollars would go to fund. So anybody that wants to participate in a nutrition program and they are what are classified as work capable between the ages of 18 and 59, they need to be working 20 hours a week, or they need to be in an approved career and technical education program, which would be funded by the dollars that are being appropriated to administer the nutrition title, the SNAP program. And this is something that 70%+ of Americans across the country, and this cuts across political ideologies, that people believe that you probably should work in order to eat. And for those individuals who can. Now, we also know that there are some folks who are, genuinely can't work, the disabled, seniors, and so on. They won't be affected by this at all. This is specifically geared toward sort of retooling our workforce, for lack of a better term. Quite frankly, in Arkansas, we have more jobs unfilled because we don't have a work-ready workforce. And so we need to take some steps that not only recognizes the need for folks to be able to eat, but recognizes the need for people to be able to contribute to that, based on your ability to work.
One thing I was going to ask about, does this bill increase or change crop subsidy programs?
There's very little change to what we're seeing here with regard to programs that are administered by the federal government. For example, price loss coverage, which is a prominent program in the Mid-South. So, rice producers, soybean producers, cotton producers, and the other crops overwhelmingly opt into price loss coverage. That's something that will continue. The reference prices were not increased. The other program, agricultural risk coverage, that's something that you see predominantly in the upper Midwest and the corn growing regions, but it has become less attractive to those growers, and so you're starting to see more and more transition to the PLC program. Both of the programs are continuing. There were some corrections to the ARC program because there was some disparity with regard to data collection from county to county postings that you may farm in multiple counties, and so therefore the coverage that you might get under ARC would vary county to county, even though you live in this place. And I mean, it happens here too. I mean, in Arkansas, we have people that don't just farm in Poinsett County. I mean, they may have ground in Cross County and Jackson County as well, or they may have ground in Cross County, Woodruff County, Jackson County, or whatever. And so they're dealing with three different county offices potentially, and under ARC they would have different data. And so what they wanted to do was correct that and make sure that everybody, there was some continuity in that program. So those are the kinds of things that you saw addressed on the commodity side, but maintained a very fiscally sound approach to this. But my argument has been and will be that the investment that we make in production agriculture yields in many, many times over to the benefit of the consumer, and primarily in our national security. Without having the ability to feed and clothe ourselves, we become vulnerable to our enemies. And all you have to do is look at Venezuela to see that. Nations like Venezuela, Cuba is another one, they can't feed themselves. But one of the things that folks probably don't talk about that much is China. China can't feed themselves. They have a population of, north of 2 billion, I guess, and they can't feed themselves. And so they have to rely on a whole lot of outside sources to be able to maintain, a certain basic level of nutrition that they can't meet on their own terms. And that provides a little bit of insecurity for that country, and actually quite a bit of insecurity for that country. They're such an economic juggernaut that people don't necessarily think about it in that context. But they are really kind of compromised because of their inability to feed themselves. And I don't want to see that happen here in the United States. The other thing is, China subsidizes their producers, not just in ag, but every industry, at an exponentially higher rate than we do here in the United States. And yet they still struggle with things like food security in China. That presents a national security challenge to them. We are, unfortunately, we're not in that situation yet. But if we decide that we're just going to forego any kind of support for agriculture, it might not take long before we get to that point. And so we need to recognize the investment is just that. It's an investment in national security that benefits everybody here in the United States, not just the farmer. The farmer is the direct steward of that investment, but the farmer is a pass-through entity. And the real beneficiary is the consumer.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us here on KASU. How important are those programs to Arkansas farmers?
Well, at this point, they're very important. And, our lenders, our ag lenders, look at these programs and recognizing that they provide a very basic level of security as these farmers, in particularly in East Arkansas, are going out and preparing their crop loans for the coming year. And so we want to maintain a level of continuity so that You know, certainty matters in just about every endeavor, and it certainly is the case in agriculture because there's so much that you can't be certain about in the inherent risk in agriculture. What you don't need is to create a whole lot of uncertainty from the government's perspective. But I think most farmers experience a level of frustration. Most anybody that's working in the ag industry, experiences a level of frustration with government involvement. And so we have a regulatory regime that's difficult on ag producers, particularly ag may be one of the most heavily regulated industries you can run into. And that presents a challenge, and the cost associated with that presents a challenge. And, you know, so what they want to see is policy that, you know, is helpful to them, things like trade, things like, you know, something simple like Dodd-Frank. How does that affect me as an ag producer? How am I going to be treated with regard to my status as an end user in the commodity market? Am I going to be considered a swap dealer? Can I hedge affordably and effectively under the constraints that are dictated by something like Dodd-Frank, which is a financial services regulatory regime, but it affects agriculture and affects bankers? So, I mean, there are all these things that emanate from Washington from a policy perspective have the potential to greatly conflict with production and increase costs. And when you increase costs of compliance, ultimately the cost of our food goes up. And what we want to do is reduce the market basket at the consumer level, at the retail level. And how we do that is by reducing, you know, the compliance costs, the costs associated with farming in the United States. And then the other problem that we face is, quite frankly, it's hard for farmers to pass those costs along to the consumer. So in many cases, they're absorbed at the producer level, at the wholesale level. So there's very little opportunity, particularly in, you know, you look at the dairy industry as a prime example. They're pure price takers. They have very little stake in what the price of their product is for them. So, you know, things like this, we've got to be diligent about making sure that we're doing everything we can to stabilize the ag economy, because that stabilizes our food economy.
Do you expect any other challenges as this bill moves forward?
Yes, there always is a challenge in the Senate. A lot of it has to do with, you know, simply the fact that they've got that 60-vote threshold over there. That's one complicating factor, but another one that is particularly difficult to deal with, and that's the geographic nature of a farm bill. And that is, producers up in the upper Midwest, for example, have a totally different perspective on agriculture, and therefore their representatives have a different perspective on what constitutes a family farm. What does a family farm look like in Iowa versus what a family farm looks like in Arkansas? And our farms are family farms, just as they are anywhere else. But we have economies of scale here. We have more land. We have more land dedicated to agriculture. We produce, I believe, on a, you know, as a per producer basis, at a much higher efficiency rate than they do in places like Iowa. Excuse me. So, what we struggle with is, what does the American farm family look like? And if you're in Iowa, you have a decidedly different view. I mean, they have what I call the American Gothic view of farming. And that, if you recall, the iconic picture of the farmer and his wife with the pitchfork and the barn in the background, and you know, that kind of thing. That's a family farm, but you know, an operation here in Arkansas that may be a group of family members, brothers, cousins, uncles, whatever, aunts, wives, sisters, that create these farm entities and operate them under a corporate charter, just as every farm operation. If you're not a corporate entity, you're probably in trouble with the IRS. I don't care how big or small you are. And so, quite frankly, here's what it looks like. If you're from Iowa, you know, your dad works in a factory, farms, you know, when he's not at the factory working. Mom may be a teacher at school. They've got 2.2 kids and a dog. They've got 160 acres of corn and maybe, you know, 30 head of mama cows, and that's a family farm in Iowa. And if you deviate from that, you know, strict idea of what family farming is, then now you're venturing off into this notion of corporate farming that is really a myth, and it's certainly not the case down here. We have a lot of hardworking family farms that have been very successful and do very, very well in their ability to produce at a high level based on economies of scale. The more ground you have as a percentage of your production, I mean, increases because your costs go down. So you can spread the cost out over greater acreage. Your production is more efficient, your costs are lower, and your money goes a lot further. So, you know, we see more of that here than we would in, say, places like Iowa or Illinois or Indiana.
How would you compare the 2018 Farm Bill with the last Farm Bill in 2014?
Well, I think it's going to be very, very little to compare or to contrast. I mean, they're going to be very, very similar, maintain a great deal of continuity from one to the next on the production side. What you'll see is a further step into modifying nutrition programs. There was an attempt made last time. It was not very successful. This time around, I think what we've seen is there is certainly a desire to reform the way these programs are administered, and a lot of that's going to take place at the state level. So we're empowering the states to administer these nutrition programs based on the needs of their state, giving a great deal of flexibility to the states to administer these programs, which I think is entirely appropriate. What we don't want to see, the progress that's been made in Arkansas, be stymied because in Massachusetts they want to do it different, and so they think they ought to, you know, that should be adopted as a national standard, because the last thing we want to do is take a Massachusetts standard for nutrition programs and apply that across the country. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. You know, they calculate their error rate as like 37 cents on the dollar. If you're not making an error, and it's, 37 cents or more, then you're not making an error. And so that's about a 37% efficiency rate. That's not good. So what we want to see is a more efficient administration program, greater degree of accountability. Under the current law, there are lots of incentives that are put in place for the states to actually exploit the program by being bonused for a certain amount of people that they bring into the program, whether or not they're eligible. Categorical eligibility is a program where you go into a program and apply for example, LIHEAP, a low-income home energy assistance program. You apply for that. In some states, you're automatically eligible, and you will receive SNAP benefits, whether you ask for it or not. That's ridiculous. It's inefficient. It's unnecessary. And that needs to stop. And so things like categorical eligibility are going to stop, and we're going to make sure that the states are incentivized to be better stewards of taxpayer dollars. And so as they start to implement the program more efficiently, the money that they save in many cases will stay in the state and be plowed back into those programs. That actually benefits the state. So it's in their interest to be good stewards of those taxpayer dollars and implement a program that is sustainable, as opposed to continuing to cost more and more. And this is really the first foray into welfare reform that President Trump has talked about. And he specifically said if there's not a work requirement included in the nutrition title of this farm bill, he won't sign it. When he made that statement, he wasn't talking to us in the House. He was talking to those in the Senate, because that's where we'll see more than likely, a very watered-down version of what we're trying to offer. And quite frankly, I think the president prefers our approach and has indicated that he wants to see a work requirement because, as I said before, this is the first foray into welfare reform, which essentially what we're talking about is entitlement reform. Mandatory spending. And, you know, the problem that we have here in the United States is that over 66% of our federal budget is on autopilot under the mandatory spending category. So it has to be changed if we're going to change the trajectory of our debt problem here in the United States.
Last question. How would you respond to critics who have said that the 2018 Farm Bill will be much worse than the status quo?
Well, it just sounds like the status quo is for them to criticize without having read the bill. This bill is a considerable improvement, as I said, on the nutrition title, but maintains a continuity in a very cost-effective way on the ag production side. So all you have to do is read the bill. And if you're just going to make those comments in the abstract because the Republicans are often offering a farm bill, and so it must be bad if the Republicans are offering it, you know, that's very, very short-sighted. So this is kind of one of the things that we see, particularly, you know, in the national media loves to take shots at what's going on in Washington with regard to their, the party identification. So anything that Republicans do is immediately dismissed as being punitive or mean-spirited or something like that. The fact is, most of these areas in the ag production areas are what you might categorize or classify as red states. And so we have no interest in being punitive to ag producers. At the same time, we recognize how important it is to provide nutritional programs because, again, that has really no political ideology. People that need help with nutrition, I'm not interested in what their politics are. I just want to see that they're getting what they need from a nutritional standpoint. A lot of these are going to be, you know, at-risk youth that maybe the only meals they get are the meals they get at school, and they're reliant on backpack programs because the school puts that together to make sure that they've got something to eat over the weekend. We're not trying to threaten that. In fact, we're trying to improve that and enhance that and make sure that the resources that are available for folks that are in genuine need of these of help get it. But we're also trying to make sure that our workforce needs are being met as well because, you know, we're at historically low rates of unemployment. If you want a job, you can get one. It's just a question of can you acquire the skills necessary to be able to perform in the marketplace. This farm bill addresses that. This is the first step in addressing that in a meaningful way, and the nutrition title is going to lead the way in that regard.
U.S. Congressman Rick Crawford, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate you.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. That's Congressman Rick Crawford joining us every month here on KASU. And we'll have that up on our website at kasu.org. And also, you can subscribe to our podcast where you can hear these interviews back as well. Right now, expect temperatures to be near 93 degrees for today. We're already nearing 80 degrees. Expect a high near 93 for today. Tonight, a low 69. Tomorrow, slight chance of rain, high of 92. This is Morning Edition.